Chapter 7. For 2 weeks and more, we anxiously awaited the anticipated arrival of our trucks, which were meant to be forwarded by the YMCA from the port. When it became evident that they were too busy to attend to the matter, I decided to go myself with chauffeurs to bring the cars to Paris. We at once located the crates containing the two Ford trucks and the white truck, also the 60 sections of the six portable houses, severally, some on a quay, some on a freight car, and some stacked in the freight yard. The cars had been exposed to sea air and were frightfully rusty. To get the cases together, uncrate, and put together the cars, and put them in running condition took 4 days very hard work. Our chauffeurs worked tirelessly and cheerfully. Many more American uniforms are to be seen in the streets than French. We were delighted to see the Sammies, and they to see us. Miss England found a brother. Mrs. Ambrose Rutherford, nay Betsy Hayes, class of 1896, director to the members of the committee. September 1917. Saint-Nazaire, France. Liza stuck a grease-stained hand out from under the truck.
Could anyone hand me that cup of grease?
I'll get it. Kate set down her hammer, stretched her sore muscles, and shoved a small cup of grease into Liza's hand.
Marvelous.
Hand and grease cup disappeared together under the truck, and Kate took a step back and stared at their handiwork. It looked like a truck, which was in itself nothing short of amazing. When they'd gotten to Saint-Nazaire, woozy from sleeplessness after a night standing up on a packed train, they'd found their trucks on the docks, not in one piece, but in boxes. Kate hadn't even been aware trucks could come in boxes. She had assumed, if she had thought about it at all, that someone had driven the truck into the ship's hold and left it there. It had never occurred to her that it might have come from the factory in parts, or that they would be expected to put it together. "Well, of course you can," Mrs. Rutherford had said, and handed Kate a toolbox, no doubt cadged from their unsuspecting innkeeper, who had had no idea that his yard was about to turn into a garage. She had given Kate an encouraging pat on the shoulder. "It's hardly alchemy. You just follow the instructions and put the pieces together. If a man can do it, so can we." By we, she meant them. Kate had been left holding a hammer and wondering what on earth she was to do with it. It was a commonplace at home that Kate was too educated to do anything useful. "Don't let Katie near the stove," was the family mantra. "She'll burn the bread while her nose is in a book." Which was a little ridiculous, given that her mother didn't bake her own bread. She bought it from Loescher's Bread Factory, day old, at a discount. Kate had always accepted that she was singularly useless, accepted it because they all seemed to believe it. But now, 3 days later, she was standing here with a sore back and sore fingers and a truck that had a top because she had hammered it on. She'd screwed on the supports and hammered on the cab and realized it was backward and cursed and pried it all out again, but she'd done it, and no one had mocked her for slowness or made fun of her for hitting her own fingers. Kate stretched her arms up over her head. Liza was still under the truck, applying grease. They'd all had way too much to do with grease over the past 3 days, and she'd probably still be sanding rust in her sleep for weeks to come. But it was only the finishing touches now. The truck was together. It was done. It might even go. She wished she could take a picture of it to send to her mother and stepfather and brothers to show them that this was something she had done with her own hands, something which had nothing to do with putting words on paper or being clever in an examination.
"Almost done,"
came Liza's voice from under the cab. Liza trailing around after Maud, Kate found deeply wearisome. Liza wearing an old slicker and squashy felt hat covered with grease was a surprisingly good companion, especially when one was flat on one's back under a car and not saying much more than, "Could you pass that whatchamacallit, please?" Liza never seemed to tire and had a cheerful obliviousness to sarcasm, possibly as a defense against a decade of friendship with Maud. Whatever the cause, Kate found it strangely restful. "No hurry," said Kate, and wandered over to see how Alice Patton and Francis England were getting on with the Ford truck. That had been a revelation, too. Not Fran England. She was just as she had always been, level-headed and even-tempered, and with a wonderfully dry sense of humor that came out under adversity. But Alice Patton, who, it turned out, beneath the flutters and the giggles and the doubtful taste in haberdashery, had a positive genius for anything mechanical. Kate had been amazed to find herself, well, not enjoying herself precisely, or maybe she was. It was good to be out in the early September air, in the sun and the wind and the salt of the sea, doing something with her hands and seeing it actually work, in the company of people who didn't ask more of her than to pass the nearest wrench. Unlike Emmy, who was wonderful and good and kind, but always seemed to need something from Kate, if Kate could only figure out what it was, or if she had it to give. "I can't believe that came out of all those boxes," Kate said, staring at the massively long Ford truck, off of which Alice Patton was sanding the final bits of rust. "I do," said Fran England, wrestling with the crank. "I had to pry open every one of them, and I'm not sure my back will ever forgive me. I think this crank is possessed, or is, at the very least, a German agent. It just won't go. Have you tried putting more grease on it?" "It's bathing in grease," said Fran. "Elbow grease," said Alice with a giggle. "I'm not sure my elbows have any left," said Fran, shaking out her wrists and examining the offending appendages. "We'll grease them with a glass of burgundy at dinner tonight," suggested Kate. "I'll drink to that." Fran came back around the car to stand next to Kate. "It does look impressive, doesn't it?" "For something that came out of a box 4 days ago? Absolutely," agreed Kate. "Now we actually have to drive them," said Alice, putting down her rag and coming to join them. "Who's the French saint for inexperienced drivers?"
"I thought you knew how to drive," said Kate, twisting her neck to look at her.
Alice fiddled with her earring.
My sister's husband, took me out a time or two and let me turn the wheel. I said I could drive so the unit would take me, and I think I can. Maybe."
"I haven't driven for 6 years," confessed Kate.
"I'm a very good driver," said Fran England, and for some reason that struck them all as hysterically funny. And that was how Mrs. Rutherford found them, clinging to each other's shoulders, howling with laughter.
"Did I miss a joke?" Mrs. Rutherford asked.
Kate managed to choke in her breath, tears streaming down her cheeks. She wiped them back with a grease-stained hand.
"Nothing worth noting," she managed,
exchanging a glance with Alice Patton, who was choking into her own handkerchief.
"Well done, ladies, and ahead of schedule, no less," said Mrs. Rutherford. "No one would ever guess you aren't seasoned engineers."
That almost set them off again.
"I don't think she'll think we're quite so wondrous when we run her off the road," giggled Alice Patton.
"You'll be fine," said Fran England.
"But I think I'll let you go ahead."
And they were fine, mostly. One of the Fords was extra long, which was quite useful for piling on the giant pieces of prefabricated building materials that Mrs. Rutherford insisted would turn magically into living quarters and schoolhouses, but also meant that there was a great deal of truck they couldn't quite keep track of. The man whose stall they knocked over was very nice about it, especially after they bought all his onions.
"What are we to do with these?" asked Alice Patton, holding up a string of onions and staring at it blankly.
15 similar strings adorned the cab behind her.
"Make soup," suggested Kate,
and ducked as Fran lobbed an onion at her. They'd barely made it 10 blocks, the long Ford seizing up and having to be re-cranked twice, before they got held up behind a series of very official-looking cars outside a large building flying an American flag.
There was a group of soldiers milling about, very excited and surprised to see a convoy of American women driving three trucks. One of the Sammies, a tall man with brown hair and an open, wind-burned face, began waving frantically at them. "Fran! Freddy! It's my brother! Excuse me!" Fran England slid down from the cab of the Ford. Kate, who was sharing the white with Margaret Cooper, tried to remember how to put it into park.
"I think it's this lever," said Margaret, pulling it for her.
Margaret, Kate had learned, was an excellent driver, although she said very little about it. She still apologized periodically for fainting on Kate, which Kate found awkward for both of them.
"Thanks,"
said Kate, and slid down from the truck, which wasn't white at all, but simply made by the White Motor Company. They found themselves in a mob of American soldiers, all tremendously excited to find women who spoke English, ready to be friends with anyone who knew Fred England's sister, anxious for news from home, and all extremely disappointed that none of the women could tell them anything about the baseball season. Margaret Cooper immediately found someone who had a sister who was her year at Smith. Kate was left to talk to two others, and in want of something to say, gestured to the house behind them, the one flying the American flag. "That building, is it the American consulate?"
"It's a sort of clubhouse," said one of the men, exchanging a look with another.
"They mean it's a body house," said Fran England calmly as they went back to their abandoned trucks. She climbed back up into the Ford, sitting down on the board over the gasoline tank that served as a seat. "My brother told me. He said when our troops first landed, there was a line that went down three blocks."
"That's dreadful. Don't their commanders do anything about it?"
demanded Liza. Her eyes looked even more like glass doll's eyes than usual, round as a cartoon in the Sunday papers. "Sure they do," said Fran. "They demand the first spots in line." Kate coughed to cover a snicker.
"It's not funny,"
said Liza earnestly, holding on to the side of the truck.
"I've heard it's all a German plot. They're getting French loose women to seduce our troops to undermine the health of the American army."
"I'm sure our boys would never think of visiting a French body house otherwise," said Fran, straight-faced. Liza looked from Fran to Kate, wounded.
"It's true. I heard it from a woman at the YMCA."
"Who I'm sure heard it from the Germans?" guessed Kate.
"Well, no, but someone reliable. Maud says it's dreadful, and it's every American woman's job to keep our boys on the straight and narrow."
"Does Maud's fiancé know that?" whispered Fran to Kate as Kate passed by on her way back to the white truck.
"Maybe he's her own special reclamation project,"
Kate whispered back, and went to join Margaret Cooper in the white. It was like college again. College with the threat of impending destruction, that was. She felt like she was playing a theater role. College Kate, the Kate who bantered and laughed and pretended to be just like everyone else. The difference was, in college, she had really thought she was just like everyone else, that being secretary of the Literary Society and volunteering with the Dramatic Society washed out all the differences, made her one of them. She'd always had an ear for languages. It had been easy to snuff out any lingering traces of a Brooklyn accent, until she didn't even have to think about it anymore. Her voice had changed, just as she had changed. It was so easy with Fran and Alice, who didn't know her, who knew only that she was another Smith girl and a member of the relief unit, to pretend to be that person again, to actually be that person again. They didn't look at her and see a charity girl. They didn't know she was a charity girl. She was just Kate, who had done her fair share putting together the white truck. But they were going back to Paris, where Emmy never meant to make her feel less, but always did. Not to mention that Julia would be sure to put her in her place given the chance. No, it wouldn't do to get too comfortable. They'd only find her out eventually. Kate winced at the memory of Maud on the boat, assuming her mother was her nanny. She'd meant to tell her. She really had. Or maybe she hadn't.
"Watch out for the...
Oh, bother. Kate bit her tongue hard as the truck hit a large pothole. Would you like to drive for a bit, Margaret? You're better at it than I am. The rain started just after lunch, hardening from a mist into a persistent drizzle, turning the roads to sucking pools of mud, soaking their hair under their hats, and dripping down the backs of their slickers. The long Ford's crank seized. The white got a puncture. 1 minute it was rolling along. Well, maybe not precisely rolling. 1 minute it was slogging slowly but fairly steadily through the mud, and the next it was listing to one side, and Kate was clinging to the doorframe to keep from falling out, and Margaret was in her lap. The extra long Ford behind them skidded and fishtailed, but mercifully Fran was driving. She managed merely to knock down part of a fence rather than hitting them, which Kate greatly appreciated. Ahead of them, oblivious, the Ford jitney, holding Liza and Mrs. Rutherford, grew smaller and smaller in the distance through the gusting rain.
Bother, said Kate, slithering down. Bother, bother, bother. Can we patch it?
It was sluicing down now. She had to shout to be heard over the wind.
Too far gone,
said Fran, struggling over in her slicker, her boots squelching in the dark mud.
We'll need the spare.
Their cars were half on, half off the road. An army truck, going just a bit too fast, honked angrily at them.
Maybe one of these nice men will help us,
hollered Liza, waving her arms over her head hopefully, but the army truck blazed obliviously past, coating them with mud in the process.
They probably don't realize we're female, gasped Alice, slipping in the mud and just managing not to fall. Just look at us.
Fran spat mud.
What the fashionable chauffeur is wearing this season, she said, and got the jack out of the back of the white.
Mm-hmm,
said Alice, dancing around behind them.
Mm-hmm.
What?
Screamed Kate.
5 inches,
yelled Alice, who had read all the manuals.
You need to get it up 5 inches to get the wheel off.
It might as well have been 5 feet. It took them an hour, working in pairs to get the white up high enough to take off the wheel, and nearly as long to pump up the spare tire by hand and fasten it into place, which would have gone faster if their wet and muddy fingers hadn't kept slipping off the nut.
We'll get better at it with practice,
said Margaret Cooper, her hat dripping rain all around her face.
I hope not, muttered Kate. I'm not sure I could take any more practice.
Fran grinned wearily at her.
We'll all be strong like bulls by the time we're done.
Or mad like bulls,
offered Alice. It was full dark by the time they made it as far as Nantes, having managed, in the course of a day, to go all of 40 miles. They found the other Ford parked neatly in front of an inn, and Mrs. Rutherford and Liza sitting down to soup and war bread.
Only 260 miles left to go, said Kate, slumping into a chair.
They had paused only to scrub at the worst of the mud with the 2 inches of cold water allotted them by the innkeeper. The result was, at best, mixed. It was a blessing the lighting wasn't good. The mud just looked like shadows. It also disguised what was in the soup.
It's going to take us a week to get back to Paris at this rate,
said Alice, dragging her spoon through her soup.
It's going to take a week to get to the next town at this rate, said Kate.
I wonder why no one has invented puncture-free tires,
mused Liza, who hadn't spent the day wrestling with one.
Because then the tire companies would be out of business,
said Fran, dunking her war bread in her soup to soften it.
Do you think they dropped the nails on the road?
Asked Kate.
No, that was probably the Germans,
said Fran, straight-faced, and Liza nodded eagerly in reply.
They think of everything,
said Kate, and wasn't sure whether to laugh or cry, so just gave up and ate soup instead. It was only 9 o'clock when they finished their meal, but it felt like midnight. Outside, the rain continued to sluice down. As she left the table, Kate found Mrs. Rutherford sitting in a tiny circle of light in the sitting room of the inn, surrounded by papers. I'm working out schedules, she said. We've so much to do that we'll accomplish it best if we're all divided into committees.
I had thought committees were a sure way to ensure nothing actually got done, said Kate, too tired to mind her words.
Mrs. Rutherford didn't look up from her charts.
That depends on the committee. Of board society women, yes. Here, it simply means that those who can, will. It's much more effective than one woman trying to oversee everything, especially when we're undertaking so much so quickly.
There were six categories on the page: house, social services, nursing, supplies and stores, motor, children.
But none of us are nurses, Kate said. How can we have a nursing committee?
None of you were trained mechanics either, said Mrs. Rutherford imperturbably.
And yet our trucks still run.
When they run.
A puncture is an act of God, or of the French roads, which is much the same thing, said Mrs. Rutherford, writing busily. You can't blame yourself for it. You aren't responsible for everything, Miss Moran.
Based on the list, Kate wasn't responsible for much. She had been put down to serve on two committees, motor and house. That was good, she told herself. She wouldn't know how to do any of the rest of it. She supposed she should count herself lucky there wasn't a separate category for instruction in the French language. There also wasn't a category for farm labor. She thought of Emmy's earnest study of chickens.
But what about the farm animals? There's no category for agricultural endeavor.
That comes under supplies and stores, said Mrs. Rutherford.
You didn't think we'd be caring for the animals ourselves, did you?
I'm not sure what we're meant to be doing, said Kate honestly. She wouldn't ordinarily have admitted as much, but she was so tired, and the little circle of lamplight felt like an island in the middle of stormy seas, a space out of time. Mrs. Rutherford looked up from her work, surprised.
I'd thought I'd explained. It's really very simple. What we're trying to do for them is give them the means to rebuild for themselves. We don't want to beggar them or make them feel the objects of charity. What we do is give them the materials to work. Rags for braiding, yarn for knitting, straw for weaving. We'll run a store with food and supplies below cost, but not for free. Pride can be as important as bread. They've lost so much, these villagers. Many of them were once prosperous farmers, storekeepers, innkeepers, and now they're living in holes in the ground, sharing one sheet. We need to leave them their pride.
Pride. Kate remembered being six and the well-meaning social worker who had singled her out at school. That had been during the lean years, when her mother had done her best, but that best hadn't extended to new coats or shoes, and Kate had grown so terribly fast.
That poor child, the woman had said. Doesn't her family care?
She'd worn those new shoes, but she could feel them burning on her feet still. She would rather have gone bare. It was odd to be on the other end of it, playing Lady Bountiful, her mother called it. Good enough for some.
Won't they mind that we're selling below cost then?
Mrs. Rutherford smiled up at her.
No, they'll just feel glad they got a bargain.
It's no shame to put one over on the Americans. They'll think we don't understand their money yet and enjoy shaking their heads over our naivete. Good night, Miss Moran.
Good night, said Kate, and went slowly upstairs, feeling like Mrs. Rutherford's plans might be somewhat less mad than she had previously supposed.
The rain continued to persecute them. Margaret was right. They did get better at changing punctures, although it didn't get any more pleasant with practice. Whether it was the Germans or just French cart horses with loose shoes, the roads from Nantes to Paris appeared to be positively strewn with nails, all of which aimed straight at their tires. They ate their lunch as they went to save time, shoving down cheese and crackers and gulping coffee from a thermos, taking turns driving. Kate began to accept being wet through as an inevitable law of nature. And then, just north of Chartres, the sun came out. What is that great yellow ball in the sky? Asked Fran.
That's the sun, explained Liza helpfully.
Kate squinted up at the sky. Unless we're hallucinating and it's just a mirage. It might be a mirage. Fran put her hand up, palm out. My hand is dry. It's real. It was amazing what a difference a bit of sunshine made. They didn't even mind when they drove into Versailles, the home of kings, and promptly blew a tire right in front of the mayor's house, which looked like a miniature palace itself and very French. This time, they collected a crowd of interested citizens, all wanting to know who these shabby American women were and what they were doing charging about on three trucks loaded with building materials and the remains of 15 strings of onions, now rather soggy. While a few helpful soldiers debated the best way to jack the Ford, which apparently involved getting a petit blanc from the nearest cafe and discussing the meaning of life, an elderly woman in deep mourning, holding a little girl by the hand, approached Kate, wanting to know who they were and what they were doing. We're members of the Smith College Relief Unit, Collégien Américain. Kate's brain felt addled by days of driving. We're here to offer aid to the former occupied zones near a town called Grécourt. Those are bits of houses we're bringing to build, for a mairie and a schoolhouse and whatever else is needed. Do you have relatives here? The woman asked. None at all, said Kate, feeling a little silly. I'm not even French. My family is mostly Irish. No need to mention that her father was Bohemian. It was a little too close to German. To be Irish was bad enough, but at least not Bush. To her surprise, the woman put a hand on her shoulder.
You are a good girl. One moment. Marie, wait with the lady.
Kate and the little girl were left regarding each other. The girl couldn't have been more than six, and Kate had no idea what to do with her. Do you live here? Asked Kate.
Yes, now.
The girl took her thumb from her mouth.
I used to live somewhere else, but then I came on a train with Madame Le Pensier. How far away is America? Did you come on a train?
Mercifully, at that point, the grandmother returned, her arms laden with packages.
For you,
she said, shoving half a chicken, a basket of peaches, and a whole cheese into Kate's arms. Kate, surprised, grappled with it to keep it all from falling. But this is... There was no need. The old woman rescued a peach and pushed it firmly back into Kate's hands.
My granddaughter. She was evacuated from the occupied zone last year when the Germans let some go. If she had stayed...
She shrugged, a Gallic gesture indicative of all manner of ills.
She was one of the lucky ones. What you do, it is good. Que le bon Dieu vous bénisse, maintenant et à l'avenir.
What did she say?
Liza, drawn by the lure of food, came up as the woman was departing, leaving Kate, dazed, cradling a roast chicken, probably the woman's supper for the week. She said, Kate's voice felt husky. She cleared it and tried again. She said, may the good Lord bless you, now and in the future.
That's so kind of her. Oh, is that cheese?
While the soldiers debated the best methods of tire maintenance, the girls fell on the food, plunking down on the steps of the mairie and tearing into the chicken and cheese.
My mother would be appalled.
Alice Patton tried to wipe the chicken grease off her shirt front. She says a lady never eats in public.
I don't care what anyone thinks, as long as there's more of this cheese in the world, said Liza. I'm surprised they're being so nice to us. Maud says the French are pretty down on us for not coming in before and feeding the Germans through neutrals. You can see how it would make them bitter to see all these strong men in new uniforms coming in, tooting around in big cars all the time. Dr. Foster, you know, the Red Cross man, said there was a pretty serious mutiny in the French army this spring, and that all that kept them from throwing the towel in was our coming in, but that we probably left it too late.
Fran grimaced at Kate behind Liza's back. Liza's news bulletins, they called her rambling digests of intelligence gleaned from Maud, some of which were contradictory, and most of which had Germany victorious within the month. Kate craned her head, looking back in the direction the woman had come. She wished she could thank her. She wished she could pay her. With rationing and meatless days and the lean days of winter so close, that was a ridiculous amount of bounty to press on a stranger. "You are a good girl," the woman had said, and she'd given her chicken. All because Kate had said they were bringing supplies to the formerly occupied zone.
"That our troops won't be ready to go in until spring, and the French are just holding on by sheer nerve."
"Excuse me," said Kate to the others, and pushed up off the steps to where Mrs. Rutherford was sitting on the side of the Ford, meditatively munching a chicken wing. "Why did she do that woman? Why did she give all this to us?"
"When the soldiers marched off to war," said Mrs. Rutherford, "the women lined the streets, handing out bread and wine. It didn't matter that they didn't have much to give."
"But we're not soldiers." Kate pressed her fingers to her temples. They smelled like ripe cheese. It made her feel vaguely queasy. "I don't understand. We haven't done anything yet."
"You're here," said Mrs. Rutherford. "That's doing something."
She said it so matter-of-factly. Kate looked at her askance. Mrs. Rutherford wiped her greasy fingers daintily on her handkerchief.
"It is, you know. It's not all grand gestures, just the fact that you came overseas."
On the steps of the mairie, the other members of the motor committee were merrily eating peaches and basking in the sunshine. Kate looked back at Mrs. Rutherford.
"What if we make a mess of it? What if we leave them worse off than they were before?"
"I'm not sure that's possible," said Mrs. Rutherford. "Most of them are living in roofless cellars, and those are the lucky ones. But I tell you, to know you are there among them, living with them, bringing aid from a world they thought forgot them, that means almost as much as the physical goods we bring them. You don't need to do anything or even say anything. You just need to be there."
"But we are going to do something."
"Well, of course," said Mrs. Rutherford.
She chomped down on a peach with obvious relish.
"It would be madness to come all this way and just stand there."
Kate, contrary to instructions, just stood there. She hadn't been entirely honest with Emmy back in Paris. Maud had tried to recruit her for the coup, not on her own behalf, but on Emmy's. "If you could use your influence with your friend," had been the phrase used. Kate had disclaimed any influence and generally avoided committing herself. "Don't get involved. Keep your head down." Those were the rules she had learned over the years. The truth was, she hadn't been sure Maud was wrong. Now, she wondered if Emmy was right, if they ought to tell Mrs. Rutherford. But what would be the point? They had their trucks, all their plans were in hand, it would only be making trouble. It was probably all a tempest in a teapot. For all she knew, Maud had never even written those letters. "It is good," the old woman had told her. "You are a good girl." Mrs. Rutherford thrust a chicken leg into her hand.
"Here, keep your strength up. Eat your chicken and let's get back on the road. If we make Paris tonight, we can collect the others, pack up our parcels, and be on our way to Grécourt by Monday."
Chapter 8.
We made our long overdue start for the country on Tuesday, September 11th. The lateness of our start made lunch an immediate concern, but Miss England, who was driving the Ford truck, insisted on a downgrade as a stopping place. Apparently, the roads in France run remarkably level. Cannibalism was staved off solely by the discovery that someone had remembered to pack a hamper with bread and cheese, which prevented Miss Shaw from gnawing on the nearest available arm, which I fear was mine.
If our women refrain from killing each other, I believe we shall deal reasonably well together. Note the caveat. Betsy, as always, remains entirely oblivious and is primarily concerned about the conveyance of our cows. Dr. Ava Stringfellow, class of 1896, to her husband, Dr. Lawrence Stringfellow. September 11th, 1917. Paris, France. They left for Graycourt on Tuesday. They'd meant to leave by 10, but noon saw the three trucks belonging to the Smith College Relief Unit still sitting stranded outside the hotel on the Quai Voltaire, occasioning a great deal of comment from passers-by. It turned out that even when limited to one suitcase and one duffel bag apiece, there was a remarkable amount of luggage, particularly when one added in such sundries as rakes, hose, crockery, portable stoves, 18 cots, blankets, and all relevant bedding, not to mention 6 loaves of war bread and 1 very precious tub of jam.
"Maybe if you put the confiture there," suggested Alice, fluttering around, trying to rearrange packages and generally confusing matters.
"Where on my head?" demanded Julia, who was wedged in between a spare tire and half a dozen folded cots. There were 4 of them in the white truck, crowded in among miscellaneous crates and packages, rakes sticking out the sides like pikes at the Battle of Agincourt, only with fewer men in doublets.
"It has to go somewhere," said Kate.
"I'll hold the jam," said Emmy,
wondering if it was too late to suggest that Kate and Julia go in separate cars. She juggled the bucket of jam from one knee to the other, trying to find a comfortable spot.
"Doesn't confiture sound much tastier than jam? Just like framboise sounds a million times more elegant than plain old raspberry."
"They're French raspberries. Naturally, they're more elegant," said Kate, grinning back at her. And Emmy felt like old times, like setting off for a picnic on a borrowed sledge.
"Can you grab the oil can, Alice?"
Alice Patton obediently clamped the oil can between her feet, and Emmy shifted sideways to give her more room, eliciting a sharp cry of distress from Julia, who plunged forward to protect her medical bag, at the expense of her own kidneys if necessary.
"Emmy, watch your foot. If you squash my bag, we'll have no medicines at all."
The doctors had returned from their tour of hospitals only the night before and had been incensed to find that their medical supplies still hadn't been forwarded from the port, and that the chauffeurs hadn't thought to look for them.
"Sorry, I didn't mean to."
Emmy tried to wedge her feet in between the oil can and the petrol crate. Her Aunt May, Julia's mother, who had dainty, tiny doll feet, had always said Emmy's feet were too big. She could feel her cheeks flushing with old shame as she tried to hide her boat-like boots.
"It's a tight fit."
"If the bag is so precious, hold it on your lap," said Kate from the front of the truck.
"If anyone had thought to look for our supplies," said Julia.
"If anyone had bothered to tell us to look."
"How far is it until Graycourt?"
asked Alice, wiggling uncomfortably between the spare tire and the petrol crate.
85 miles, said Kate. "But goodness only knows what the roads will be like once we get out of Paris."
"Are we ready to go? Once I start this, I'm not stopping it again until I find a hill pointing down," called out Fran England from the Ford truck.
She and Margaret Cooper were driving the long truck, loaded with parts of portable houses and miscellaneous farm equipment. In front, leading the way, Liza had the jitney, with their duffel bags, suitcases, Mrs. Rutherford, Dr. Stringfellow, Miss Dawlish, and Maud. Emmy wondered if Mrs. Rutherford was following the old adage of keeping one's enemies close. 3 members had been left behind in Paris. Miss Ledbetter, who wrote features for magazines, had been detailed, on the strength of her journalistic credentials, to coordinate with the press. Miss Mills, who had been working at the Villiers Hospital, was being allowed a week's rest before starting for Graycourt, which Emmy really hoped wasn't code for her having picked up something terribly contagious. Miss Baldwin, their librarian, had stayed behind to try to beg, borrow, and cadge books for the children.
Alice Patton turned the crank of the white, and Kate did something. Emmy supposed she really ought to learn how it worked at some point, although she wasn't sure it would be fair to inflict her lack of direction on the world at large, and the truck started rolling forward, past the hotel, across a bridge, over the Seine. They were on their way. They were truly on their way. At last, at last. The French sun shone down on them, blessing them in their endeavors. Everyone waved to them as they passed, old women in black veils, women in overalls sweeping the streets, soldiers in gray and soldiers in khaki, mothers wheeling babies in carriages, and men limping on crutches. It felt like a parade, like a festival day, like a Roman triumph, like Ivy Day at Smith. Fair is the earth today, blooming over the lay, and June is calling, Emmy sang, unable to contain herself. It was their Ivy Day song, the one they'd sung together as they processed around the campus in their white dresses, escorted by the alumni in their colored sashes, helping to launch them away into the world. After a moment, Kate's careful contralto joined in. Away! Ah, come away with me! Then Julia's trained soprano, carrying over them all. Away, away, to the world so bright and free. Auntie May used to make Julia practice for hours with a voice teacher, then trot her out to sing at parties, posed with a harp. Julia had hated it and had staunchly refused to sing in any of the college musical societies, no matter how they'd begged. But she was singing now. They were all singing together, and it felt absolutely as it should be. Emmy's spirit thrilled to the words. We hear her magical call, and we follow the world around. Her voice wasn't beautiful, not like Julia's. She tended to slide between notes, and she was often flat, but she felt like the words were drawn straight out of the very marrow of her bones. Away, away, the world around. She'd always wanted to go off on a quest like the knights in a romance, and here they were at last. Even if it wasn't, as she'd told that British officer, anything heroic, only something practical and decent. But right here, right now, she felt like all the heroes of romance rolled together, armed with a rake instead of a sword and a bucket of jam in place of a buckler. Leave we our love behind as the low winds softly croon. Oh, heavens, look at everyone stare, said Alice Patton, breaking off with a self-conscious duck of her purple hat as the white truck jolted down the Rue de Richelieu. There's the opera. Maybe they want to recruit us, said Emmy giddily. Or run us out of town on a rail, said Kate, making a face but smiling all the same. I think I'm already sitting on one, thank you, said Julia smartly, trying to shift a rake handle from her posterior. The truck went over a bump, and Alice squealed as the crate of precious petrol bumped against her knees. Oh no, that's left blue paint all over my skirt. At least it's French blue, offered Emmy, trying to hold on to the holiday mood. From the wheel, Kate called, Don't you dare drop the essence, Alice. It's a dollar the gallon. We'll never be able to afford more if it spills, and then where will we be?
Singing for our supper? Offered Emmy.
Pushing the trucks, most likely, said Kate. Uphill, all the way. Julia looked at Emmy sideways. I'm sure Aunt Cora would stump up for gas money if you applied to her humbly. Emmy could feel her cheeks flush.
I wouldn't want to. That is, she hated to be reminded of her mother's money.
It made her feel as though she weren't really one of the group, but only included in the hopes that her mother might open her purse. And that wasn't the case, not this time. Her mother hadn't contributed, at least not more than anyone else. Except for one thing. There was one thing Emmy had asked her mother for, but no one needed to know about that. It was quite beside the point. Emmy fell back on generalities.
You know she thinks it's important we do this properly, through raising funds and all that sort of thing.
Oh, yes. It creates character, I gather. Julia's voice was drier than day-old war bread.
I hear the New York committee has stumped up wonderfully, said Alice, and Emmy could have hugged her if she hadn't been afraid of upsetting the petrol.
My mother wrote me that they've all taken up knitting and have been making the most tremendous things for the children, said Emmy. I've asked them to send chocolates for the children. They're so frightfully expensive here, and I want to make sure we have enough for everyone.
I wouldn't mind a chocolate right about now, said Alice wistfully.
Do you think Fran will let us stop for lunch anytime soon? I could eat a cow.
The cows are being sent separately, said Emmy, who had been responsible for buying them.
And thank goodness for that, said Kate with feeling.
Emmy glanced back over her shoulder. She couldn't quite eat a cow, especially since they were rather depending on those cows for milk, but she wouldn't mind stopping for lunch sometime soon. The Ford truck was motoring steadily along behind them, clearing the road of taxis and pedestrians alike as it barreled forward. Miss England had both hands on the wheel and a look of extreme determination on her face.
Was Miss England serious about stopping only on a downgrade?
Kate exchanged a look with Alice Patton.
Oh, yes, she said.
Alice fiddled with the oil can.
Do you remember that time?
Outside Chartres, said Kate.
We had to pile all the pieces of the house back on, said Alice, grimacing. Goodness, those were heavy.
At least Fran didn't take off the fence that time.
Or the onions. Remember the onions?
Kate wrinkled her nose.
How could I forget? My uniform still reeks of them.
They did make excellent soup, though, said Alice.
At that inn, you remember the one.
Are you sure those were onions in the soup?
Asked Kate, and they both laughed. It was good that they were getting along so well, Emmy told herself. It was important for morale and camaraderie and all that sort of thing. It was very silly. No, not just silly, it was downright selfish to feel left out just because the chauffeurs had come back from their jaunt to Saint-Nazaire with not only the trucks, but all sorts of shared jokes and experiences.
Would anyone like some bread and cheese? She asked.
They ate bread and cheese, even Julia unbent to take a little, which meant she must have been very hungry indeed, as the road wound through a forest in all its leafy beauty. They were well out of Paris now, following the jitney through a landscape that felt like something out of Arthurian legend. It seemed impossible to believe, among these trees, that there was a war on, until they got to the end of the forest and saw the first blasted village. Houses crumbled in upon themselves, rubble upon rubble, like a block village after Emmy's little brothers had run amok. Except these hadn't been blocks. These had been buildings. Real buildings, where people had lived and worked. The trees here weren't leafy anymore. They were stunted, twisted things, the branches and bark blasted off by artillery, leaving only blackened stumps in their wake. Along the bare horizon, Emmy could see tangles of barbed wire, long stretches of churned earth and abandoned encampments, and in the midst of it all, the bright, incongruous red of flowers, like splashes of sealing wax. Or the Scarlet Pimpernel, she thought, and wondered why she was thinking of that now, of the little red flower and the Englishman she had last seen at the Gare du Nord headed back to the front, who might, even now, be food for flowers, another man lost in the trenches, his bones sunk deep in the mud of the Somme. The jitney stopped, said Alice.
I think that's a guard post up ahead,
said Kate, slowing the white truck and just managing to pull around the jitney instead of bumping into it. Mrs. Rutherford waved them forward. They climbed awkwardly down from the truck. Emmy was rather amazed that she could be so sore just from sitting. She hurt in places she hadn't been sure one could hurt.
We're to show our feuille bleue, said Mrs. Rutherford.
Not our carnet rouge?
Asked Alice, digging for her papers.
I feel like a French lesson, whispered Emmy to Kate.
Avez-vous le carnet rouge de ma tante et les plumes jaunes de mon cousin?
Oh, bonjour, monsieur. Here's my carnet, my
Three? You know the one.
Emmy smiled apologetically at the guard, feeling like an idiot, but it seemed her papers made more sense than she did because he waved her forward. She supposed she didn't look much like an enemy agent. As Auntie May liked to point out, she seldom looked like much of anything. Kate's papers passed scrutiny, and then came Liza, and the whole procession stopped.
This paper, said the guard, holding it up so they could see. It is for Monsieur Shaw.
But it can't be, said Liza blankly. It's me. I mean, it's meant to be me, for me.
I assure you, mademoiselle, it is, said the guard,
and he held it up. There it was, clear as day, on Liza's feuille bleue. M. Shaw.
Does she look like a man? Demanded Maud indignantly.
That is the problem, exactly,
said the guard, not bothering to hide his boredom.
This paper permits Monsieur Shaw to enter the zone des armées. If Mademoiselle Shaw wishes to enter, she must go back to Paris and get another paper.
It's a mistake, said Emmy, wondering how on earth none of them had seen it before. Of course, they didn't tend to go through each other's papers, and the writing on the safe conduct was next door to illegible, but even so,
you can see it's a mistake. I could drive her back in the jitney, said Margaret Cooper hesitantly. Maybe we could fit everyone else in the white and the truck. Oh no, said Emmy.
It wasn't just that they couldn't possibly fit everyone and everything into two of the cars. It was that they were meant to be a unit, and she had the oddest feeling that if anyone turned back now, that would be the end of it.
I'll come too, said Maud quickly. If everything else is this ill-organized, I don't want any part of it.
There's no need for that. It was Julia who had come forward, speaking in her perfect, beautiful, aristocratic French. Emmy always forgot that Aunt May's second husband had been a French count. He might even have been from somewhere not far from here. Emmy had never been entirely sure where the Count's chateau was, only that it needed a new roof, and her mother firmly refused to pay for it.
If you won't believe us, will you take the word of Le Soir?
Julia held out a page cut neatly from a newspaper, folded so that the photo of the Smith College Relief Unit, all 17 of them, was staring up at them. Emmy waved enthusiastically at the photo.
You can see, that's us, and there's Mademoiselle Shaw, you see?
Liza obediently perked up, trying to look like her photo.
We're les collégiennes américaines.
Les collégiennes américaines, eh?
Said the guard, studying the photo. In it, they were arrayed in two rows, Mrs. Rutherford and Dr. Stringfellow seated in the middle. Emmy wished she didn't look quite so tall, looming in the back row, and that someone had told her that she needed to brush her hair, but the overall composition seemed to be having its effect on the guard.
All the way from America?
It was amazing, thought Emmy, that a newspaper could do what all their passports and carnet and feuille hadn't. She was very impressed that Julia had thought of it, although she did rather wonder why Julia had bothered to cut out the article at all. Julia wasn't the sort to keep a scrapbook of their adventures, which reminded Emmy that she really needed to start keeping a scrapbook of their adventures.
Do you know, said Mrs. Rutherford cannily, as the guard handed back the newspaper,
we never did have lunch. Would you care to share our bread and cheese with us? We might have a bit of jam put by as well.
The confiture clinched it. By the time the bread and jam had been eaten, they were all firm friends, and Monsieur Shaw had become a great joke, with Liza laughing hardest of all, even if her laughter did sound a bit forced. It was just a little delay, and they would have been on their way at once, if their oil can hadn't rolled off and had to be retrieved.
I do think if they didn't want oil cans to roll, they ought not to have made them round, contributed Alice.
I wonder if the children might like to construct a square one, mused Miss Dawlish.
Half an hour later, the oil can had been wrestled back into place, and the Ford refused to start. I told you we needed to stop on a downgrade, said Fran with grim satisfaction. Another hour passed. With their new friend, the guard, working the crank, and four of them taking it in turns to push, the Ford condescended to move again. It's past five, said Julia grimly. We're barely halfway.
At least we're not halfway back to Paris, said Emmy. It was clever of you to think of the paper. I hadn't realized they'd printed an article about us already.
Oh, several. This was the most fulsome. Julia looked sideways at Emmy. I intend to send them all on to my mother.
Oh, how nice, said Emmy,
even though it wasn't really at all. It represented a declaration of war, or rather, the continuation of a war that had begun a long time ago, when Julia had announced her determination to go to Smith, and Emmy's parents had agreed to pay her tuition and board.
You can't mean to encourage Julia to become a spinster, Aunt May had raged at Emmy's parents, so loudly she'd heard it all the way through the oak doors of the drawing room and the marble entrance hall and into the music room. Spinster. The word had a sting to it. But that was what they were, weren't they?
The paper called them girls, or rather, being French, jeunes filles, but the truth was that all of them, with the exception of Miss Cooper of the class of 14, were closer to 30 than they were to Ivy Day. Emmy generally tried not to think of that sort of thing, to tell herself that she was married to her good works, but there were times when the truth stared glaringly out at her, and she could hear Auntie May's voice from long, long ago saying, with shattering clarity, "It's a pity she looks so much like her mother." That hadn't stopped her mother from marrying, but her parents' marriage was something Emmy tried not to look at too closely. She liked to think that her handsome, dissolute father hadn't married her mother entirely for her money. She didn't think he had. Her father respected her mother, she was sure he did, and they had liked each other enough to produce seven children. But there was no denying she had no desire to recreate their circumstances. She didn't want to be married for her dowry and left to do good works while her husband spent his time drinking at the Union Club, or dining in the private rooms of Delmonico's with actresses young enough to be his daughter. Oh no, said Alice. And Emmy dragged herself out of her muddled thoughts. While she had wool gathered, they had bumped their way into the medieval town of Noyon, where they seemed to have stopped in the town square. Emmy rubbed her eyes with the back of her hand. The dust of the road had gotten them, making them water.
What's wrong?
Alice pointed at the Ford, which had come to a complete stop in front of them.
That's not a downgrade, she said darkly.
The Ford, apparently, had stopped of its own accord. Something had gone wrong, something mechanical. They gathered an interested crowd of townspeople and soldiers, all with opinions, none of them encouraging. The sun set over the towers of the cathedral.
If we were working for the Red Cross, this would never have happened, said Maud darkly.
We'll have to stay the night, said Fran England, ignoring her. There's no point pushing on to Graycourt now. We'll never find our way in the dark.
No, said Julia, with such force that they all stared. I'm not staying.
Dr. Stringfellow stepped in.
We stayed in Noyon while we were touring hospitals. The only available room had a door leading to the main stair. We had soldiers passing through our room half the night. I wouldn't recommend it. After those air raids in Paris, I could sleep through a platoon, said Liza cheerfully.
I couldn't, said Julia.
Perhaps we could find someplace else, Alice suggested, fiddling with her collar.
Or we could just leave the truck, proposed Emmy, looking sideways at Julia, who was looking decidedly thin-lipped. There's nothing on it we need tonight.
Only our luggage, said Fran England.
It makes more sense to stay here, rearrange the loads, and try to find our way in the morning, said Kate, siding with Fran. It's taken us this long to get here. What does it matter if we arrive tonight or tomorrow? No one will be waiting up for us this late.
Everything she said made perfect sense, but Emmy felt strongly that it did make a difference. certainly to Julia, who looked as though she wouldn't be dragged back into that inn for all the world, and to Emmy. 2 days, the mechanic had said, maybe three. To have made it this far and be stranded in Noyon seemed intolerable.
Fran and I could stay with the truck, offered Margaret Cooper, and the rest could go on.
No need for that.
Mrs. Rutherford appeared from the scrum of French soldiers, dragging a thin man in a uniform with the three gold bars denoting a captain.
Look who I found. This is Captain Jaouen, currently of the French Army, but previously a professor at the University of Michigan. He's offered us a replacement truck and the men to drive it.
A temporary loan only, Captain Jaouen said quickly.
The camion or the men? Alice whispered with a giggle and was hushed by Kate.
So we can get on immediately, said Mrs. Rutherford. Well, as soon as we transfer our load from the Ford to the camion. The captain has said he'll have his men get started right away. We'll be on our way within the hour.
How does she do that? Asked Margaret Cooper, staring at Mrs. Rutherford as she marched off arm in arm with Captain Jaouen, discussing something that happened in Crete back in 98 or 99.
It's as though she snapped her fingers and conjured him out of thin air, like magic.
She does seem to find a way to make things happen, said Kate cautiously.
Magic, said Emmy.
4 months ago, no one had even thought of such a thing as a Smith unit, but one speech from Mrs. Rutherford, and here they were, equipped and ready, mere hours from their post, all the intricate layers of army and civilian bureaucracy dealt with, all the red tape cut through. Mrs. Rutherford had done all that, and now she'd even conjured an army truck for them.
And just think, we'll be escorted by brave cavaliers all the way.
Don't you mean poilu? Said Kate practically. Poilu were the rank and file of the French army. I doubt any of them will be on horseback.
I don't care who they are, said Fran England. As long as they're the one hefting the trunks instead of me. I can't think how she got them to do it.
Neither can I, said Maud darkly.
Only Betsy, said Dr. Stringfellow, to no one in particular, and went to help direct the disposition of their belongings.